Yeah, baby. It's episode 139 of Ask the Inspector on February 27th, I think it is. Yes, 2024. Jeff Norman and yours and my favorite weapons inspector, Scott Ritter, with you as usual on Tuesday. It's the lightning round today. That means Scott answers every question in 3 minutes or less. And I have a very important announcement to make. We have been procrastinating way too long on this, and we now finally have our two t-shirts available in special women's designs. It turns out, I didn't even realize this until recently because I'm not very bright, but it turns out that they have different cuts for women. So we still have the same t-shirts in the men's cut that we've had all along, but now, for those of you of the female persuasion, even if you're a transgender, you probably still have the same body. You can now order a shirt that will be more form-fitting.
But we don't like to use the term trans. We call it the Hoffman cut.
The Hoffman cut. The Fred Hoffman cuck cut.
Now, right. I have to make a statement here just so everybody understands.
Uh-oh, a statement. Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, Fridays, it's usually at the end of a very long week where I've done a lot of interviews and I've put up with a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, I get death threats, dozens of them a week. I get insulted a million times a day. And I sometimes have a very low tolerance for what I would call BS. And every once in a while, I go on what some people like to call a rant. And sometimes I say things in the rant that are more akin to, for instance, when I was in the Marine Corps, there would be occasion where a Marine would fail to comply with an order. And about the third time the Marine failed, I would say something like, if you don't unfuck yourself, I'm going to take you into the back of the barracks and I'm going to rip your fucking skull off and I'm going to tear your body apart and nobody will find it. Now, nobody expected me to rip the skull off and do all that stuff. It's just colorful talk that Marines do. And the Marine suddenly understood that the lieutenant was really pissed off. And then the staff sergeant really stepped in and said, sir, I've got it from here. You probably shouldn't be saying these things. And then I would walk away and everything would be done. I said some things Friday about Mr. Hoffman in relation to our combat debate. And I just want everybody to know that, no, I am not going to hunt anybody down and kill them. This is not what it's about. It's purely figures of speech. I'm a peaceful, nonviolent 62-year-old man. It's not prone to, you know, I mean,
with man boobs.
Apparently, I've got man boobs, so yeah. I should be wearing. We should actually, Mr. Hoffman, you're right. It's the Ritter cut because I have the anatomy to pull it off. But, anyways, I just wanted to make that clear in case anybody out there thought that I was actually going to follow through. No, it was. Probably irresponsible on my part. I'm not in a Marine barracks anymore. Here I am. I'm doing a public podcast and all that. But no, there weren't moobs. Sean, you hurt me. You hurt me, Sean. But
God. All right. You know, I think Fred Hoffman and I can commiserate with each other because you recently said I'm dumber than shit. And, you know, you probably didn't mean that literally. And likewise, you didn't mean literally what you said to him. So I think Fred and I can get together and talk about you behind your back, and I can calm him down if he's upset, is what I'm saying.
That's all right. I don't care if he's upset. I just am letting the audience know that.
Oh, it's for the audience, not all him.
I care about the audience. I don't care about him. So,
all right. I think for the last time, at least for a while, we should give away a coin today, and then I think Friday night we should give away one of these women's t-shirts. Wouldn't that be a nice gesture for the women in our audience?
But that's very, unless the man is a secret transgender or he's buying it or raffling it for his significant other. But in the case of Fred Hoffman, his significant other might be another guy. And I just don't want to, why don't we raffle off a shirt? And then they get to pick whether they want the male shirt or the female shirt.
I want to argue with you between now and Friday night. The thing is, we've been neglecting the women so far. Therefore, I don't think it's improper to give them a little special.
You win, boss. I am. Look at me, Mr. Compliant here.
Does the word reparations mean anything to you, Scott?
Reparations means a whole bunch, and we should have reparations for what we have done here. Yes.
All right. So, but today we're going to give away the coin, either the Scott Ritter challenge coin, which Scott gave away last May when he went to Russia, or the one he gave away when he went there in January of this year. The winner will get to choose. Just type in hashtag coin in the live chat to enter the drawing, and we'll give it away at the end of the show. So let's get to the questions from our beloved audience. Yelena the Magnificent is handling backstage duties today for us. Let's get to it. The first question is from a name that I'm not even going to try to pronounce in Serbia. If you think you can say it, Scott, you can just, I'll hand it over to you.
But Aksinia. The question,
what's that?
Aksinia.
Aksinia, all right. In Serbia, what are your thoughts on the self-immolation of Aaron Bushnell? Obviously, it's a tragedy, and he was a very brave man, but I'm interested in what you have to say, seeing that he was a member of the U.S. Army.
Well, he was a member of the U.S. Air Force, and I'm just being a stickler on the details. Aaron Bushnell was... I mean, I don't think we should just define him by his active duty military status. He's a human being, and he, apparently he's a human being who has some, has a heart, has some compassion. If you go to his social media page, he makes a statement there. I'm paraphrasing it, but basically it's something along the lines of, a lot of people wonder what they would have done had they been alive when Adolf Hitler was around, what they would have done during apartheid, what they have, would have done. And he mentioned several things about, you know, major moral issues and what they would have done. And he said, you're doing it, which means nothing, nothing. You're doing nothing. And that's sadly the reality for the vast majority of people out there. You're doing nothing. And I think he, you know, he was a man who wanted to do something, and he's a man who had orders to go to Israel, and he disagreed. These were mandatory orders. And he felt he needed to make a statement with his life. He's not unique in that regard. A Buddhist monk made a similar statement in Vietnam back in the early 1960s. We've had people do similar things in other situations. And, you know, now it's up to us, those who he's challenged. What would you do? I think what we need to do is never forget Aaron. We should honor what he did. I'm not a big fan of suicide. I'm not a big fan of... I'm definitely not a fan of setting myself on fire, but, you know, we can defer to the words of the British musician. Why can't I remember his name right now? He wrote the song Biko, but, you know, you...
Is that Peter Gabriel?
Peter Gabriel, that's right. You can blow out the candle, but you can't blow out a fire. Once the flames begin to burn... the rage will burn it higher. He set himself on fire. That fire is going to be put out, but maybe he lit a fire in our collective souls. Maybe he lit a fire in our collective, consciousness. You know, we're going to see an asshole cop come in with a gun, pointing a gun at a burning man. I mean, it shows you the attitude of police in America today, but let's forget that. Let's talk about Aaron. Let's talk about what needs to be done. Let's not let this flame go out. Let's make this flame burn higher and higher. And let's do something. Free Palestine.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, actually, now you mentioned the cop with the gun. I've seen, hang on, I'm sorry about that. I've seen different reports about what agency that guy with the gun was with. Do you know for sure?
I don't know for sure. I was told that these are all uniformed Secret Service officers.
Right. Now, I'm with you on the sentiment, so please don't bite my head off too much, Scott, but I had another thought about why it might have been valid for him to pull the gun. Because wouldn't somebody who's committing suicide also possibly have an explosive device on them or something like that, and it would be appropriate to then fire if he saw him looking to detonate that or something like that? Is that not a possibility? Are they not trained for those possibilities?
American police officers are some of the most poorly trained law enforcement officials in the world. They get a lot of firearms training, but they're not given it appropriate training on how to use the firearms under what conditions, de-escalation, the whole thing. If you think pulling a gun on a man on fire on the ground is an appropriate response, that's your bit. No, I don't agree with that at all. The dude is clearly down. If he has a detonation device, at what time is his burning body twitching going to signal to you that he might set it off? Go ahead and fire a bullet into a suicide vest. I mean, maybe that'll set it off, or maybe get a goddamn extinguisher and put the guy out.
Right.
I mean, this was stupidity in the extreme. It just shows you again, the mindset of American cops. They're not there to help people, to serve and protect. Forget that. They don't serve you, and they're not there to protect you. They're there to pull guns on you and shoot you. I mean, there might be some exceptions out there. I know there's some exceptions out there, but that's just a ridiculous thing. He didn't go into
it. Let me ask you another question about the response. And I think probably most people don't know that you were a volunteer firefighter for many years. So you have some expertise there, as well as the expertise that everyone's familiar with. And there was a voice yelling, "Get down on the ground, get down on the ground." And there was some criticism about that too. And then I saw others respond to and say, well, that is a way that makes it easier to put the fire out. It wasn't like, "Get down on the ground, I'm going to arrest you," or something like that.
Bullshit. It's a cop saying, "Get down on the ground." It's not a firefighter saying, "Get down on the ground, let me help you." It's a cop with a gun out saying, "Get down on the ground, get down on the ground." Because that's how American cops respond. Look, I'm not.
Well, there was more than one thing going on there. There were also people who got fire extinguishers. So I'm just trying to be fair.
There was one guy that got a fire extinguisher, and he asked people to get other fire extinguishers. It took him time to do so. Had the cop with the gun gotten a fire extinguisher, you might have two fire extinguishers on the body at a time. Look, the kid was going to die. I mean, the damage had already been done. What was burning after that wasn't going to save him. I'm just saying that. I think that showed a lot about police response in America today. That's all I'm saying.
All right. Max Blumenthal posted on X his reporting instructions, and it mentioned going to Israel to serve in his capacity as an Air Force person on an active duty. Now, my question for you is, well, since he wasn't actually sent there, and this is dated November 21st, what does it mean? It doesn't seem like it's orders to go now. What is it saying? Maybe be prepared. We might send you there. Could you explain what this means exactly?
Well, this is dealing with the Air Force, and this is dealing with the reserves, and this is dealing with modern science. But reporting instructions, I think, again, I have to check. Was this guy reservist? Was he active duty? I'm not sure. It supersedes all previous Israel reporting instructions. It provides specific guidance for airmen and guardians deploying to Israel. Guidance. It's not an order. It's guidance. Refer to recommended changes and questions about this publication. There's five pages. I'd like to see what's on the other five. This is a cover sheet. Compliance with its guidance is mandatory. So it's probably telling you what you need to do in preparation for the potential of reporting to Israel. 21 November 2023 isn't the report date. That's the date of this document.
Right.
So I'd have to see the rest of the pages before I could make any further comment. But the bottom line is, clearly what this is saying is that American Air Force personnel are being deployed to Israel for missions that are related to ongoing situations in Gaza, and that he felt that he could not comply with these orders and that he was not going to be complicit in the ongoing genocide. So he took the actions that he did.
Right. And I think that was Max's point in posting it, is that, he wasn't just some guy who was upset about it in a detached way. It was actually directly affecting his life.
No, there's no doubt about it. Look, the tragedy is this. The tragedy is that Aaron didn't feel, for whatever reason, that he could reach out to somebody in his chain of command, or maybe he did and he got a negative answer. I saw in the comments, I'm not supposed to read them, but I saw someone said, "Well, what would you do in that situation?" It's a difficult question because If I were in that situation, I'm the commanding officer of a unit that has to fulfill a military mission that has been given to them by the National Command Authority. It's a constitutionally valid order until deemed otherwise. You signed up. Missing movement is a big deal. That's why we call it desertion or absent without leave. If you are a conscientious objector, there are ways to do this, but I have to be careful because, you know, missions are difficult. And am I going to open the door for my entire unit to suddenly say, well, we don't want to go. We're not going to do this because we suddenly have this feeling or that feeling. Then I'm one hell of a bad leader because I just lost my unit before we even crossed the line of departure. So, you know, there are things that have to be done. I have to say that I probably would have come down hard on this person. I'm just being honest right here. I mean, today I'm talking nicely about him, but as a military commander, I would have come down hard. I would have given him counseling. I would have sought out counseling. But I would have told him that he has a choice to either report or face, you know, uniform code of military justice, disobeyance of a direct lawful order. You joined the military. Should have thought about that before you raised your right hand. When you join the military, you don't join saying, well, I only support pro-Palestinian causes, or I only support pro-Israeli causes, right? You don't, there's no cause out there. It's not about you supporting any cause. You obey the lawful orders of your chain of command. And if he was given an order to report in preparation to a deployment to Israel, he needed to obey that order or be willing to pay the consequence. He decided to make a political statement of it, and he made that statement with his life. And you have to respect that. You have to respect that. And I do. I respect what he did, and I personally support his cause. But someone asked me to step back into the you know, as a commander of individual of this nature, I would have put him. I would have, first of all, subjected him to counseling. I would have had him assessed. And if someone deemed that he was mentally distressed, I would have put him on suicide watch, and I probably would have had him removed from the orders and prosecuted. I mean, that's the bottom line. I would have had him prosecuted for failure to obey a lawful order.
Okay, one more point that I think is worth making before we move on to our other questions. Most of the mainstream media organizations that covered this story didn't even mention what his reason was for killing himself. And here's a look at a few of them. This is the New York Times. They didn't mention it. Reuters didn't mention it. CNN didn't mention it. The Washington Post didn't mention it. NBC didn't mention it. The only major media organization I found, and I'm not claiming I searched exhaustively, but the only one I found was the New York Post.
Yeah, my understanding is that Israeli media also covered it as a Free Palestine issue as well, which is ironic that the Israeli media is more open to telling the truth than the American media.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to our next question. It's from Name Doesn't Matter in the USA. How do we put the most lawful pressure on the local and federal government to stop the genocide of Palestine?
Vote them out of office. that's the most logical thing. You make this a position, a policy position, and you attach consequences to failure to comply with the will of your constituents. And then if you can get enough constituents who share your opinion, you let it be known that unless you change your stance come election day, you will be unemployed. That's the best way you can. I mean, that's the lawful way to do it. How else do you put pressure on government? You can do protests, you can do demonstrations, but to be honest, if you don't have, you know, sufficient mass behind you, they don't care. That's been proven over and over and over again. The only time politicians care is if their jobs are on the line. There's very few politicians that take a moral stance. They lie, cheat, and steal. We saw Chuck Schumer, talking to Joe Biden on a, caught on mic moment where he just did straight up says, I'm lying to my donors. I got this donor that I got to continue to let him believe that I'm willing to do this, that, and the other thing. But once that's taken care of, then we can do this. So he's lying to anybody who's giving money to Chuck Schumer. Understand, you're a sucker. He just admitted he's just playing you along to take your money. That's politicians, every single one of them. They're all dirty as hell. And the only way you get a politician to do anything is to challenge them with sufficient votes that if they fail to comply, those votes are guaranteed to put them out of office. That's it. On this issue of genocide, is it a big enough issue to get the votes you need? Maybe, maybe not. It's a tough one. But you said lawfully. I mean, so there it is. That's my lawful solution. Get enough votes.
Okay, that's lawful. Next question comes from Ian in Canada. Apart from the fact that she is not difficult to look at, what is your take on Tulsi Gabbard since she jumped from the Dems to the Republicans in favor of Trump's take on things?
Well, I don't know Tulsi Gabbard personally. I mean, I certainly would have loved to have an opportunity to talk to her, to dig deeper into her belief system, her values, etc. I used to be a big fan of Tulsi Gabbard. Again, I'm just saying that it was on a superficial basis and not about her looks. It was because I agreed with her stance on, war and on the need to, exhaust options before going to war. I thought that was responsible. So there's sometimes she took a position. I said, I'm not thrilled with that, but that's life. Jeff and I are very good friends. And yet there's issues that Jeff and I disagree on. It doesn't define our friendship. It's a reality of life. My wife and I have been married for 33 years and we get along very well, love each other deeply. There are things we don't agree on. It's life. It's okay to disagree. It doesn't mean because I disagree on this issue that suddenly Tulsi's not a viable candidate. And I don't care about her party affiliation. In today's insane political world, what used to be a Democrat isn't a Democrat anymore. And so if you started in politics 20 years ago and you defined yourself as a Democrat and you take a look at the Democratic Party today, you may not identify that. If you started 20 years ago as a Republican, you look at the Republican Party today, you may not identify that with that either. So I'm not going to let that get me. It's how she stands on the issues. And now it's really difficult because Tulsi Gabbard, she's a player right now. She's in the game. Her name has been thrown out there as a potential vice presidential candidate, which means everything she says has to be couched in that way. And so she's taken a very hardline stance on Israel right now that I fundamentally disagree with, fundamentally. And so I would have to say, given this whole genocide thing, I'd need to talk to her before I could throw my support behind her without any question. I need to find out, what her limits are on genocide. And then I'd say, well, haven't you reached that limit yet? And what are you doing about it right now? It's a difficult situation, but she's an American politician right now. She's a mainstream politician, which means you have to take everything she says with a heavy grain of salt because she's playing in the big game right now. And honesty and integrity have never been, a major part of the big game.
Well, the questioner referred to as a Republican. I'm not sure that's accurate. I think she identifies as an independent, although one could argue that she's appealing to Republicans now, but I don't think she calls herself a Republican. Let's take a look at her speaking at the CPAC conference a few days ago.
Now, for me, 20 years ago, I joined the Democratic Party because I was inspired by Democrats who took a stand for peace, who protested against the Vietnam War. I was inspired by leaders in my home state of Hawaii who fought for plantation workers who were being abused and exploited by their wealthy landowners. I was inspired by leaders like Martin Luther King, JFK. And I was drawn to the ideals of the Democratic Party at that time that welcomed all people from different backgrounds and views, that stood up and fought for working men and women, fought for the little guy, and that actually took a stand for free speech. for civil liberties. Now, as I stand here before you today, I am no longer a Democrat. Because I could not in good conscience remain in a party that's under the complete control of an elitist cabal of warmongers led by the queen of warmongers herself, Hillary Clinton, and embodied by President Joe Biden today, leaders who are driven by cowardly wokeness.
Would you agree, Scott, she's rejecting the Democrat Party but not embracing the Republican Party?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think she clearly says she doesn't identify with the Democrats, and she clearly didn't say she identifies with the Republicans. So she's walking a middle ground there.
Next question comes
from... But I will say this about that. Walking the middle ground, sort of the coward's way out. I'd like to know where she stands if she wants my vote. What she's doing is she's playing a game right now, a political game, which is fine. But I think we need to know that she's playing a political game.
Well, are you saying that an independent is by definition a coward?
She didn't call herself an independent, did she?
Well, not in that clip, but I think she does.
Then why is she speaking before CPAC? That's not an independent forum. She's playing a game, Jeff. You know it. It's like me going to AIPAC and saying, well, I don't necessarily support Israel, but I'm happy to be here at AIPAC. CPAC is not an independent forum.
Right. Well, as I said at the beginning of this little segment, one could certainly argue that what she's saying appeals to Republicans. So, okay.
Sure. There's no, it appeals to some Republicans. There's some Republicans who it doesn't appeal to.
Oh,
Mark
and also
the Navalny story.
Yeah.
I tell you what, Mark, why don't you come here and help me write this thing? This is a beast. A beast, and I want to get it right. So rather than rush it through and get it to Jeff an hour before we go on show, and then Jeff has to do a rapid review of my bad grammar and fumble around with the photographs and then put an inferior product out there where people, instead of saying, wow, this is really good, say you misspelled this, you misspelled that, just take a chill pill and you'll get it when you get it. I'm shooting for Friday's show. But again, I got to get this thing right. It's a big story. It's a big issue. It's got to be done right.
All right. The best part about that answer was your empathy for my plight in the process.
Jeff, I'm trying to be empathetic towards you after I said horrible things about you that I still continue to this day feel bad about.
All right. Well, I don't want you to feel bad, but empathy is good.
Too late.
Michael from Riga, Latvia. What do you think about Macron's posturing about NATO troops in Ukraine? It seems like the EU and America do not accept the eventual fate of Ukraine and will do anything to keep it going.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh, and I'm eating into my 3-minute timer. First of all, understand this. NATO will never deploy to Ukraine because it requires a consensus upon all of NATO. And that isn't going to happen. Macron is talking about sending, having individual nations sign a security agreement with Ukraine. It would allow them to deploy troops to Ukraine on a unilateral basis. Understand that the second you do that, you lose Article 5 protection. So those troops go to Ukraine and they have no NATO protection. They're not operating under a NATO shield and they will die. They will all die. And not just that, but the Russians would have every right to say that not just the troops on the ground in Ukraine die, but everything that led them there, including decision-making centers in the country in question, which if it's France means Paris, can be struck by Russia legally, and they're 100% right. Now, that could create some sort of weird debate within NATO about Article 5, et cetera, that Russia may not want to have happen. But, there's no free ride. Your troops that you send there are going to die. Now, the idea is that they would send their troops not to the front lines, but into the rear areas to secure maybe the border with Belarus, to secure other things, to free up troops that could then be made available to the front line to give Ukraine this artificial boost. But I can't imagine the Russians saying, yeah, that's all right. Cool. No big deal. No, the Russians will kill them all. And if I were the Russians, I would literally thrill in killing them just to make the point that we told you not to do this. It's like telling, you know, somebody as you're cooking, you know, don't put your hand on the burner. When it's red, don't put your hand on the burner, and you watch him approach it. I'm going to put my hand on the burner. Dude, if you need to put your hand on the burner, do it. Oh, God, I got burned. No kidding. I told you not to put your hand on the burner. Russia's told France and everybody else, don't put troops on the ground in Ukraine. If you do, you die. And that's what's happening. I don't think they're going to do it because what it shows, though, is the desperation in Europe right now because they know what's happening on the ground in the battlefield. They know that Ukraine's got nothing left. That's why they have to do this. They need emergency send troops to free troops up. It's an act of desperation, but I don't think anybody's insane enough to follow through on this.
All right. Scott, I'm sure you remember our friend Phil in London. He has won me over because he sent me, and I want to share this with you actually, a playlist that he made of Bob Dylan covers. It's a very lengthy set and it's packed with a lot of goodies. And I've listened to it twice so far and enjoyed it immensely. Now, Phil has left a voicemail message for you and I would like to play it now. This is not about Dylan. I just thought I'd mention that.
Phil is loquacious. Remington 870 or Mossberg 500, Ithaca Model 12 Featherlight. That's it. Old fashioned pump.
You were talking over Phil's question. Did you hear
him? No, Phil never even showed up.
What? You don't hear that?
I don't hear a thing. No one else does, I don't think.
What happened?
Martha doesn't hear Phil. I'm with Martha. Nest of Moon says, no sound.
No sound.
One Team Boy says, we can't hear it. Adam says, we can't hear it. Jeff is experiencing technical difficulties. I can't hear anything.
Oh, all right. Well, he thinks that our most important nation as far as getting along with them geographically, politically, and everything is Mexico. And he's asking you to comment on that.
I mean, look, Mexico is an extraordinarily important nation to the United States. We're neighbors. Our economies are interlinked. We have a very large Hispanic, apparently Phil whispered. We have a very large Hispanic population. Mexican culture and heritage is a significant part. Cinco de Mayo is a thing because of the large Mexican-American population. And border security is important. We need Mexican assistance on that. We have problems coming in from Mexico, for instance, with drug trade, the cartels in Mexico. We need to work with the Mexicans to resolve that problem. So it is a... It definitely is one of the most important nations, along with Canada. I mean, you have to have good, am I referring to the model? God, we're getting into shotgun debates. We'll get back. But we have to have good relations, and it's important to have good relations. I focus on Russia because of my skill set. I'm a Russian area expert, or I got expert, elevated myself, specialist. I studied it in college. I am a nuclear weapons person, an arms control person. Those are my areas of knowledge. And so that's how I apply myself. But just because I basically have focused on Russia, and I do feel that nuclear weapons, given the lethality of that they possess and the terminal results that would be achieved if they were used are a very high priority, one that I'm putting my focus on. But that doesn't mean for a second that I think that we should be dismissive of the importance of the U.S.-Mexico relationship. So, Phil, what I'm going to say is I agree with you in principle, but in terms of practical application, I will continue to put my focus on Russia.
All right, I don't want to spend too much time on this. I'm trying to fix the audio on the fly. Tell me if you can hear him now.
Hi.
Yes.
In the long term.
All right, good. Let's move on to the next question. TJ in Moscow, were Woodward and Bernstein anomalies in American journalism in getting through to the truth of Watergate? Where is the quality investigative journalism of today to see through the so-called American aid money that flows to the defense contractors?
Well, I think that there's a lot of quality investigative journalism out there. I think Jeff mentioned one, Max Blumenthal, Aaron Maté. We can just go down the list over and over and over again. But these are, you know, Glenn Greenwald does a great job.
Oh, yes.
You know, so these are people who are part of what we call alternative media. That's not the mainstream media. Mainstream media, the enemy of truth resides in the editorial offices and in the owners. The owners set forth priorities, and the editor must adhere to those priorities. Those priorities are driven by government, by advertisers, by money. You don't have, you know, editors of the courage that existed back when, I think Ben Bradley might have been the owner or the editor of the Washington Post when Woodward and Bernstein were doing their Watergate thing. Cy Hirsch talks about can't remember the guy's name now. I actually interviewed him, but the editor at the New York Times and the courage that they had. But that's back when newspapers were expected to do this job, that this was what they were about. They went to the Supreme Court. You know, New York Times versus the United States was the ruling about the Pentagon Papers. We don't see that today. They're avoiding that fight. James Risen, who I'm not a fan of, by the way, I'm not a big fan of James Risen, but, you know, he was compelled to write a book about stories that his newspaper wouldn't let him write when he was there because it was too politically controversial. The government wouldn't be happy about that. What is the newspaper there to please the government? Apparently so. No, there's plenty of quality journalists out there. Who are digging into the story. The problem is that you have to hunt for them. You have to go to independent media to find these stories, and then you'll be informed. But if you're waiting for the story to come out of, thank you, David Crosby, for legacy media, I like that term. If you're waiting for legacy media to do its job, you'll be waiting in vain.
Okay. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but Carl Bernstein isn't so edgy and on the side of truth nowadays. In fact, CNN drags him out every single time Trump says something that to me is just ordinary political rhetoric. But Bernstein says it's a crime worse than Watergate. That's like his middle name now. Carl, worse than Watergate. Bernstein.
Well, yeah, but and Woodward's no better. I mean, he's just a hack. He's turned into a pure hack. And the funny thing is, as you start to dig in more and more about the you know, that story, you realize that it wasn't as black and white as they make it appear. There, the use of this FBI informant and stuff, the way they shaped their version of the narrative was designed to romanticize what actually happened. It I think they did a bang up job, but I also think that they were they and their editor were also politicized hacks even back then.
All right, let's take a phone call. Hopefully our audio problem isn't affecting the phone line. Let's give it a shot. Hey there, you're on with our favorite weapons inspector. Good. Can you hear it, Scott?
No.
No, he can't hear you. All right, I'm sorry. We have a problem. I'll remember your phone number, though. I'll remember your phone number. Call us on Friday night, and I'll make sure you get on. Oh, you're welcome. Bye-bye. Okay. Sorry about that. Let's see.
That new T-shirt threw the whole system off.
No, I know it. I know it actually happened. I won't bore the audience with the details, but It's not easy. Unengaged observer from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. Ukraine claims to have shot down two Russian A-50 AWACS planes, but I read a pro-Russian blogger say that he didn't believe the Ukrainian claim because Russia usually publishes the names of deceased and wounded airmen, and he saw no publication related to those Ukrainian victories. Did Ukraine shoot down those planes or not? Tell us the real deal, Inspector.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's the fact of the matter is I'm as much a prisoner to the news as you are. But let me put it this way. This doesn't mean that the plane was shot down or not shot down, but the A-50U AWACS flying the profile that they were showing flown over that region is a critical aspect of identifying, the tracking for intercept and destruction, the storm shadow missiles, the scalp missiles that are used by Ukraine. And, if one of these were downed and Russia can't fill that gap rapidly, that's a big problem. I mean, Russia would need to bring in capabilities able to meet that surveillance requirement, because if you drop that, you suddenly have strategic vulnerability. So I don't think Russia would be rushing to say, yep, you shot it down, baby. We don't have any coverage. We're wide open, open season on us. I don't think they'd be rushing to admit that. So we have to see. This is wartime. And, they say the first casualty in war is truth. While I'm not saying that Russia lies, I am saying that Russia, just like every other nation, isn't going to reveal things that empower their opponent. And losing a strategic asset like the A-50 would be something that would empower the Ukrainians. The Russians, if it was shot down at some point in time, I believe the Russians will say, yes, we lost this asset and these are the casualties. But to admit it right now, especially if they haven't fielded a capability that meets the A-50 standard, there's no reason for Russia to admit this right now. They're not in the business of pleasing you and I. They're in the business of winning a war. And if Ukraine scored a tactical victory, you don't want to turn it into an operational or strategic victory by revealing too much too soon.
All right. We have a voicemail message from David in Melbourne.
Hello, Scott and Jeff. This is David from Melbourne, Australia. I hope you're both doing well. The question I have for Scott is, I know Australia has a long-standing relationship and alliance with the United States, and we've fought side by side with American brothers in arms in every major conflict since World War I. But I also acknowledge and believe that it's in Australia's best interest to be friends with Russia and China. And it's seeming more and more that our alliance and partnership with the United States is making that goal less and less achievable. So I just wanted to get Scott's thoughts on how Australia can best navigate those waters to maintain our good relationship with the United States, but also open the door to being friends with China and Russia. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the question. When I was in the Gulf War, there was a Major Hogan, who later on became General Hogan, I guess. So he did a good job, but he was an intelligence officer attached to the Special Operations Command. Central Command is a intelligent enhancement person, but he and I spent some time together, and I have great appreciation for him. One of my best friends from my inspector days is an Australian Lieutenant Colonel, Roger Hill. We're still friends today. An Australian officer of great integrity and great capability. While I was an inspector, I had the honor and privilege of working with Australian soldiers from a wide range of professional capabilities, including combat medics from the Special Air Service, a very special breed of man. And I have great regard for the Australians. I've been to Australia twice, enjoyed every moment there. And the reason why I had this long bring up is that every Australian I met was one of the most independent, high-minded people in the world. Yeah, they were friends, and they considered themselves allies, but man, they had their own opinion on things, and they weren't afraid to express it. And you know what? That made them even better friends. And what I'm trying to say here is that, first of all, thank you, Australia, for being our friends, for being there when we needed you and being there when we didn't need you, but you stepped up in anyways. In Vietnam, you didn't need to be in Vietnam, but you went. Maybe you regret that decision today, but you went. And for better or worse, I thank you for that. And I thank you for being there in the Gulf War. I lost a very close friend who was one of my inspectors. He was in the Australian SAS, and he died in Afghanistan. It just ripped me apart. I thank you for the sacrifice that your soldiers have made in common cause with America. But you're not our friends if you cave in. You're not our friends if you do our bidding. You're our friends if you help us when we need help, and you stand up to us and tell us when we're doing something wrong. And if Australia believes that having better relations with Russia and China is essential for their security, then they have a duty and responsibility, not only as Australians, but as the friends of America, to stand up and tell us that, so that we're not under any false assumptions on what you are and aren't willing to do. We need to know where you stand. That's what true friends do. And it doesn't matter if you're opposed to us. That doesn't mean that our friendship is over. It means our friendship is stronger, because hopefully we'll do the right thing and try to find common ground with you on how best to approach the problems of Russia and China.
I know a guy who frequently wears a Ukrainian blue T-shirt who in the past has said that friends don't let friends drive drunk.
Does he hang out in a yellow background that makes it look like he's a Ukrainian flag?
I will neither confirm nor deny that assertion. George in Philadelphia, what military capabilities does NATO have in the Baltic states? How far into Russia could NATO project from Estonia or Latvia? Could they take out Moscow and St. Petersburg, for example? Under what conditions would NATO activate these capabilities?
I mean, what military capabilities does NATO have in the Baltic states? From what I understand, what NATO has done is deployed battle groups to the Baltic states, which are reinforced battalion size. They're talking about upgrading these to brigade-sized battle groups. And they're there basically as a tripwire force, meaning that if Russia were to invade either of the three Baltic states, that they would have to go through these NATO forces. And hopefully that gives Russia, second thought about doing something of that nature. On occasion, there's an air component, and on occasion that air component gets reinforced. To the best of my knowledge, there's been no strategic deployments of any significance to the Baltic states. There's not a standby strategic strike capability. But I also believe that Russia basically monitors this whole situation. Russia is very aware of the vulnerability of St. Petersburg, a vulnerability that's been made even more so now that Finland has joined NATO and Sweden has joined NATO. This is why they've created the St. Petersburg military district. And this vulnerability now extends because of NATO's aggressive posturing to Moscow, which is why Russia has created the Moscow military district. And I think you'll see that these military districts will be composed of forces and capabilities that help enhance the defense of both St. Petersburg and Moscow. And that's what Russia is doing to deal with this. Russia's made it clear that if they are attacked by NATO, that the response will be devastating for all of NATO. So, I don't know what more Russia can do on that one.
Okay, the next
question. Let me address a question from the comments just because I like this question. He asked about the horseman in the back. This is a Frederick Rivington bronze. It's called the Bronco Buster. And then this is, I don't know if you can see that one.
We can see it. Here.
This is Charles Russell, another American Western artist who did this one. I think it's called Going to Town, basically a cowboy getting drunk and shooting his pistol in the air. I am a fan of both of these artists, and we found the Frederick Rivington at an antique store, and I got it, and I said, man, I would really like to have a Charles Russell companion piece for that, and my wonderful wife got me it for my birthday, so I now have a Rivington and a Russell, and it just tickles me pink.
George in Philadelphia, is already, we already asked his, got his question. Unengaged observer in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Did we already have him? I'm not sure if that's the right name. But anyway, here's the question. Ukraine claims to have...
No, we had this question. It's the exact same question. Yeah.
Freeman in Italy. Zelensky recently said that Ukraine has lost only 31,000 soldiers killed in action. Do you think he has started to feel the pressure from the society so he has to lie to save face? How long can his propaganda last?
It didn't last a second. The moment he said this number, there wasn't a person in the world that believed him. The Russian Minister of Defense, Shoigu, came out and said that the number is like 444,000. And actually, the number is greater than that because there's a certain number, over 100,000 missing. So we're talking over 500,000. But whether it's 340,000 or 550,000, it's a hell of a lot more than 31,000. I can't say 31,000 since January 1st either. I think he may have lost 31,000 in the Battle of Avdiivka, but there's other battles taking place where they've lost more. Zelensky made it clear a long time ago that the, 310,000. Zelensky made it clear a long time ago that the number of casualties was a very sensitive number, as a matter of national security, and that the Ukrainians aren't going to release that number because to do so would cause tremendous trauma amongst the Ukrainian population. So I think we have to take everything Zelensky says with a grain of salt. If he's saying that there was 31,000 since the beginning of the year, 1st January, at least it's a realistic figure. It's something that we can believe. But if he's saying it's since the start of the war, no, it's not realistic.
JD in Switzerland. Biden's madhouse is not stopping the immigration. This can cost his reelection. In my view, there must be a strong reason. My guess, if a country is bankrupt, printing money is the best solution for a disoriented government. But if one increases dramatically the number of its population, printing money is possible without triggering inflation. Does that make sense to you, Scott?
Well, I think the implication is that if we allow millions of people to pour across our border, we increase our population dramatically, therefore making it easier to print money without triggering inflation. That sounds it sounds very an economist would have trouble struggling through that thing. I don't think that's how it works. But what I do know is the border problem isn't just about policy; it's about money. But the money has to be allocated by Congress. That's where the holdup is, in the House of Representatives, which is constitutionally mandated to determine budgets. And right now they've linked, the money for the border with other money, such as for Ukraine, et cetera. And they're holding the Biden administration hostage on this. And, people are saying that the Democrats have the upper hand and all this kind of stuff. I disagree. I mean, the border issue is going to be one that's going to, as the individual said in their question, define an election. And the Republicans right now have Biden in a very tight spot. It's a failed policy, and they need Biden. They're demanding that Biden change the policies or at least enforce existing laws. And Biden can't do that without admitting that he's been a failure and that Donald Trump was right the whole time. And the last thing he wants to do in a potential national election where he's going up against Donald Trump is to say, well, on one of the biggest issues of the land, you were right, I was wrong. So, I think we're going to continue to see a sign of a paralysis taking place. Mike Johnson, I don't think, is going to yield. I know a lot of pressure is being put on him, but I don't see him yielding on this issue because of two things. One, it's a winning hand for the Republicans in the national election. And two, Johnson knows that. I mean, the problem is he kissed the Godfather's ring, and the Godfather's name is Donald Trump. And he's got to do what the Godfather tells him to do. You know, it's like in the movie, there will come a time when I ask you to do a favor and you will do the favor. Well, Mike, you got the job you wanted. The Godfather's saying, this is my condition. You stand firm on the border. And I think he's going to.
Finn in Norway, journalists embedded with the IDF in Gaza. Are they there legally?
Yes. I mean, I guess the laws would be determined twofold, one by the state of Israel. And if they're embedded, that implies Israeli complicity. So they're there in accordance with the laws of Israel. Then you have to ask about the laws of their respective lands. Now, if you have a country that has determined that Israel is a terrorist nation, a practitioner of genocide and stuff, and they forbid, being embedded, then you'd be there in violation. But I think they're there legally. There's no doubt in my mind that the bigger question is, are they there ethically? And that's a different question. Because the second you embed yourself, first of all, you're a prisoner to them. They are responsible for your security, and it becomes like the Stockholm syndrome. You know, you immediately identify with the people surrounding you, and if they're saving your life, if your story is dependent upon their willingness to put you in a place secure you so you can tell your story, you're sort of going to slant it this way, even if you don't mean to. You're going to. It's inherent. Plus, the other thing is you tend to take on the lexicon of the people that you're with. And so Hamas becomes a terrorist organization and Israel becomes, you know, freedom fighters. And that's how your story is going to be before. So legally, I believe they're all there legally. Ethically, I think every single one of them is ethically challenged.
Next question is from Walton, Missouri. President Biden orders you, General Ritter, to bomb Iran. What do you do? A, try to talk him out of such action. B, resign. C, bomb Iran. Or D, other.
First question I ask is why? And what are we bombing? Hey, Mr. President, what do you want me to bomb and why are we bombing it? And if he says, just because I bomb Tehran, just because I tell you to, I say, Mr. President, that's an unlawful order. We need to have just cause, and the cause has to be defined in a way that bombing is a proportional response to it. Proportionality plays a very important role in determining the legality of the action. Now, if Iran attacked us, and this is a retaliatory strike, then it depends on what we're striking it with, and what we hope to achieve by striking that. If I agree with the president that a military strike is justified, then I will work with the president to come up with the target set that that is appropriate to the events that took place. But that question, the way it's worded, is impossible to answer properly. I mean, you know, an unconstitutional order can't be obeyed, bottom line. And, you know, simply striking for the hell of it is an unconstitutional order. In striking with overwhelming force to a minor problem, you know, Iran gave Trump the middle finger. Bomb Tehran! No, Mr. President, that's an inappropriate action. You can't do that. Hit him with a nuclear weapon! But Mr. President, they just fired a drone at us. That's disproportional use of force. Can't do that either. You know, so there's a lot of things that have to go that I'd have to know a lot more before I could truly answer that question.
Seems you're up against a lot of people who are very eager to bomb Iran, the perfume princess, as you like to call Lindsey Graham and a few others. Reminds me of that song by Randy Newman, Political Science.
They all hate us anyhow, so let's drop the big one now. Let's drop the big one now.
You know that song?
I like that song.
Yeah.
Pick your city. Pick your city. Tell me which one you want gone. Seattle, L.A., Boston, New York, Miami. Pick one, because at least one's going.
If Christiana Goulair is upset that you didn't whip me. You know why, Christiana? The timer. I keep looking at the timer, and I'm going, I got to shorten my question short, because I don't want to be whipped. Now, Christiana, are you telling me that you wish I was being whipped? We have an issue.
If so, she's a sadist. Well, after this, we're just trying it out. So maybe the audience can give us some feedback on
maybe the audience wants me to be whipped.
Maybe we can get some feedback from the audience as well as from Scott, whether this visual is a good thing or a bad thing. This is the first time we're trying it. Olga in the USA, assume that Israel is forced to employ the Samson option and eliminate Iran, after which Pakistan strikes Israel. How would the U.S. respond, and what would happen in the aftermath, given that Pakistan is one of the U.S.'s closest allies?
I mean, that is a nightmare scenario, but if Israel starts the fight and drops nuclear weapons, then and Pakistan responds, I think what we do is we step in and say enough's enough. I mean, you're done. I don't think we're going to intervene by striking Pakistan or anybody else. You know, Israel started this fight. They're the ones. Again, this is why I come back to, I'm sorry, the plastic rushing put something down there that made me laugh. It is a basketball shot clock, and I'm one of these people that's holding, buying time until I can get the last shot in. But I think we have to focus on this. If we've gotten to the point where Israel is executing the Samson option, then our non-proliferation policy has failed. And it's failing right now because we've empowered Israel to have the potential for the Samson option. At some point in time, we are going to need to, and sooner rather than later, deal with Israel and their nuclear weapons. They have to be eliminated. There's no legal or moral justification for a nuclear armed Israel, especially now, a genocidal Israel. I mean, Scott, Nazi Germany's killing 6 million Jews. Give them a nuclear weapon. Let them have a nuke. No, Israel's proving itself to be 100% irresponsible when it comes to international law. They don't care about what the rest of the world thinks. If Pakistan will not strike Israel, I don't know. If Israel strikes Iran, Pakistan's next, don't you think? I think the Pakistanis know that too. So Pakistanis have already hinted that the appropriate response to an Israeli nuclear strike on Iran is a Pakistani nuclear strike on Israel. But again, the fact that we're hypothesizing about this is insane. So we need to get into the business of, I know the Israelis have nuclear submarines. They have nuclear armed cruise missiles on board these submarines. And these are sort of their version of, you know, the ace up the sleeve. The submarines are out there on patrol. If Israel ever gets taken off the earth, these things will be able to fire cruise missiles and execute the Samson option, which is why they shouldn't be allowed to exist. We need to get rid of them. And only America could put the pressure on Israel sufficient to get them to agree to disarm. But we don't have American leadership capable of going that route yet.
Mr. Anderson in Malmo, Sweden. This is our friend who gave us advice about obtaining a visa. U.S. just sent, well, he says just sent troops. I've actually been, got this question a couple or so weeks ago, and we kept running out of time. So take that into account. The U.S. just sent troops to a Chinese island 6 miles off the mainland China coast. Is Biden crazy? How long will China put up with that? It will be unprovoked one day.
Well, my understanding is that the U.S. has permanently deployed troops in three situations. Special operations forces are deployed on this island that you speak of. I think the Cold War term name of the island was Matsu. I don't remember what it's currently called. And then the Paracel Islands, I think, or something of that nature. We have a force there, and then we have some other people that are working with Taiwanese special operations forces on drones, how to employ drones. The overall numbers are 200-300, so it's not a huge amount, but it's a permanent military force on Taiwan. I think the Chinese are following the situation, but again, the Chinese are strategic thinkers. I don't think they're going to overreact to 200 or 300 men. You know, the bigger problem is the fact that the Taiwanese are sending right now a reinforced battalion, but perhaps more, to annual training exercises, or in some case, I think it's biannual training exercises being held in Michigan that are hosted by the Michigan National Guard. And this has become a training relationship that's designed to be long standing. And you know, here you have them not just sending a battalion to be participate in war games, but they are integrating with the staff. So you have Taiwanese officers learning American staff procedures, learning how to operate within a joint force structure. That's dangerous. That's where the Chinese start to say, hey, you're building capacity so that, you know, you can just plug in Americans in rapid order if you ever want to reinforce, so that if Taiwan now builds a military force that has, you know, sockets in place already, so the Americans just have to deploy force and plug in, and now you enhance capacity. This is problematic for the Chinese. But I do think the Chinese right now are looking for a political solution over a military solution. And I think the Chinese aren't displeased with the results of the last election, where the Kuomintang has control of the parliament and is pursuing, you know, economic relations with China as opposed to, you know, militarization with the United States. So we'll see what happens. Breaks his trail of thought. Yeah, but the other guy, Didi, I'll get whipped. If I go beyond it, he's going to hit me. But we'll see. Thank you for your input, Didi. We'll find out how everybody feels about it.
Well, Scott, the time has come for everybody's favorite part of the show, when we give away the coin. And as I said earlier, the winner will have his or her choice between this coin, which is what Scott gave away last May when he visited Russia, or this one, which is what he gave away when he visited in January of this year. And so for those of you who have entered hashtag coin in the live chat, you are eligible to win. And we now have 627 people who have entered. So let's
take it to 700. Let's take it to 700.
All right, Scott. Scott likes that round number.
I like round figure. Plus, it's a challenge. I'm challenging the people right now. All we need is 47 more. 47 more people to put hashtag coin in. Look at that. We're down to 25 more. Is it? I mean, now 28. We're getting close. I mean, this is going to be done before you know it, Jeff. We can give a running count. You know, look at that. 80, 20 to go, 20 to go, 20 more people, 12 more people. I mean, by the time I finish this next sentence, we should be there. 695, 703.
We did it. You could be an auction. What do they call it? An auctioneer?
An auctioneer, yeah.
Yeah.
600, 721. All right, let's see what we get. Maybe we'll get something other than YouTube today. Colin from YouTube.
You know, Scott, I was told by someone at StreamYard that this giveaway app would work with Rumble, but I'm beginning to think that was incorrect. I think
that's wrong. Rumble has not yet won. Now, I know YouTube might be overrepresented on this thing, but nonetheless, I mean, odds are somebody from Twitch or Rumble or Facebook or anybody else would have won by now.
Well, I think Facebook and YouTube, but there's a lot more on YouTube. Anyway, we at least can get the comments from Rumble in now. So that's something. So Colin, send us an email at info@US Tour of Duty. Let us know which of the two coins you want and also where to send it. And I think I persuaded our favorite weapons inspector to embrace this concept of reparations. So Friday night, unless you object strongly, Scott, I'd like to give away one of the women's t-shirts.
How can I object to giving away a women's t-shirt? But we have to say that men can enter as well, because we are a diverse community. We respect everybody's inclinations, even Hoffman's.
Yeah. Well, it's up to the men what they do with it if they win a women's t-shirt.
Now, before we go, somebody did ask, again, I'm trying to be nice here. I'm not picking on the bad comments. I'm only picking on the nice things. When people say nice things, somebody asked me a question about what was my favorite Western movie. I think it's in reference to the fact that I have these my favorite Western movie of all times. I mean, there's a number of them, and I'll give you the top three. One is Unforgiven, Clint Eastwood. I just love that movie. The other one, I suddenly just blew the name out of my head, but it's with Kevin Costner and Robert Duvall. A great Western. And I can't remember the name of it. Great gunfighter, very realistic. But my favorite Western of all times is John Wayne and the Searchers. It is the darkest John Wayne movie ever made. His character is dark, demonic. He's tortured. The acting is great. The story is great. I just would strongly recommend that movie to anybody who's interested in the genre.
All right. There you have it. Recommendations from our favorite weapons inspector. On Friday night, as I said, we'll be doing the t-shirt giveaway for the ladies. And you may notice that my teeth will be whiter on Friday night because tomorrow I have an appointment with a Russian dentist recommended by my primary care physician, Scott. He told me, though, that he thinks this guy is anti-Putin. So do you think I should tell him about this podcast or maybe after he takes the sharp tools out of my mouth?
Well, have you ever seen the movie Marathon Man with Dustin Hoffman?
With Dustin Hoffman, yeah. I can't remember it very well, but yeah. Oh, yeah,
Are we safe? Are we safe? I don't know. I mean, it's up to you, man. If you want to play Dustin Hoffman's role, strapped in a chair, mouth open, and a drill bit bearing down on your teeth, feel free to say whatever you want.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I'm curious, but I'm also afraid. So we'll see. I'll let you know Friday how it went. I'm also going for new eyeglasses on Wednesday, although I don't know if they'll be done by Friday, so we'll see. Scott will be in Tampa on Saturday, March 16th. Maybe Yelena can flash that on the screen for us, the info for that event. And then in Chapel Hill, North Carolina on March 19th, the day after Scott and I see Bob Dylan in Fayetteville, North Carolina. I'll be okay. So looking forward to that, and we'll see
you all. Open Range was the movie, by the way, just so everybody knows. We're getting plenty of feedback. Open Range was the Kevin Costner and Robert Duvall movie. And somebody mentioned Lonesome Dove. That's not a movie. That's a television series, but it's literally one of the best television series ever made. And if you don't cry about what Tommy Lee Jones does with Robert Duvall's body at the end, you're not a man.
All right, and there's the event info for both Tampa and Chapel Hill. Thank you, Yelena. Appreciate that. And thanks to our beloved audience. And as always, thanks to my favorite weapons inspector, the legendary Scott Ritter. And we will see you all on Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Until then, be well.